let me say that this is a case of Meisenhelter versus the people, and we're hearing from a petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Esteban Martinez. I'm here representing Mr. Meisenhelter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal and begin with a few preliminary relevant procedural facts. In 2001, Mr. Meisenhelter was charged with aggravated incest. And after he was charged with that as part of a plea agreement, the prosecution added a second count. That second count was to child abuse. And under the plea agreement, he had a cap of 25 years. That plea agreement was bad per stipulation by the district attorney and Mr. Meisenhelter because Mr. Meisenhelter was advised that he would get 4 to 16 years and be charged under a subsection of the child abuse statute, which had a range of 4 to 16. But he was charged under a subsection that had a range of 10 to 32. Okay, so the court allowed him to withdraw. The prosecution amended the second count under the right subsection so that he was would be sentenced in a range from 4 to 16 years, again with a cap of 25 years to DOC. During his plea advisement, Mr. Meisenhelter was never advised that his admission of the bare elements of the aggravated incest would be used to aggravate his sentence to child abuse. He had no prior convictions. The child abuse count was wholly fictitious. There was no factual basis for it whatsoever. And he was never advised, because, as I said, that he would be aggravated based upon his admission of the bare elements of aggravated incest. And he didn't stipulate to judicial fact-finding at all in the case. And so it's very clear to me that Mr. Meisenhelter was never, because he was never apprised of his jury rights under Apprendi and Blakely for jury fact-finding of aggravating facts, that the trial court erred when it sentenced him to 25 years on the child abuse count. There was no basis for doing it whatsoever.
I mean, I understand the facts, but I thought they did this at his behest to get the sentence that they thought they had bargained for, that your client had bargained for previously.
Could you repeat that?
Wasn't this to accommodate the defense's effort to have the sentence reflect the prior plea agreement? This count two?
Yes, it was, except that he couldn't, just because the judge advised him that there was a cap of 25 to the Department of Corrections, doesn't mean that the court could circumvent his Blakely and Apprendi rights. The court couldn't
Under Lopez, if you agreed to waive, then you...
He didn't waive his jury rights under Blakely. He didn't waive the right to have a jury find facts that would be used against him in aggravation. He just waived to the finding of guilt by a jury, and that was based on the bare elements.
Excuse me. I think you made two arguments. One, I don't really deal with it, is that it's not a simultaneous conviction. It has to be a prior conviction. But on the facts, I don't quite understand. He admitted by stipulation that the victim was his daughter, right?
And that's a bare element of aggravated incest.
Right. And then he admitted the second one, that the victim was under 21. So what is there about Apprendi or any precedent that says you have to have, if you admit those facts, that prohibits or prevents an aggravated sentence from being given? Why did that? You stipulate to those facts. That part has to be clear.
Waive the jury trial. Under Isaacs and Villanueva, he should have been advised when he admitted to those bare elements that he was going to be aggravated based on those bare elements, and he was never given that advisement. And the other thing is the legislature has specific mechanisms in the sentencing scheme to aggravate somebody based on bare elements of a charge. For example, in this case, under the subsection that was withdrawn and amended to a different subsection under the child abuse statute, he could have been sentenced and aggravated to 10 to 32 years. The range could have grown that way. But he had no warning whatsoever as to how his sentence was going to blow up. He was simply advised of...
Excuse me, what about the fact that he agreed to a 25-year cap?
This was
within the 25-year cap.
It's not stated, but it appears that possibly, you know, that's based upon a finding of aggravation. And the courts always give you the full sentencing range. They say here's the presumptive range and here's the aggravated range.
Excuse me, I thought it was that he agreed in his plea bargain to a 25-year cap. Is that wrong?
He didn't stip to 25 years. He agreed to, if he were sentenced, presumably in aggravation, that aggravation would not exceed 25 years.
Not exceed 25.
Right.
So how can it have been such a surprise as you're portraying it to be?
He had some, I guess surprise is the wrong word. It still doesn't mean that the court is allowed to not advise him that he's going to get aggravated, could get aggravated by waiving his right to jury fact-finding on the facts that would be used to aggravate him.
And you said he waived his right to jury fact-finding. Can you hear me, sir? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Did he waive a factual basis? I mean, he entered this plea, and obviously there was a Rule 11 advisement, so there had to be some sort of finding or admission on his part to a factual basis.
On the fictitious count, he waived the factual basis. On the count that was completely invented, on the aggravated incest count, he stipulated to a factual basis.
Fictitious count is the negligent child abuse, is that what you mean?
Yes.
And why do you call that fictitious? You mean it was fictitious only for the purpose of the plea bargain?
Yes, it was only made for the purpose of the plea bargain.
But so he waived on that one?
He did. So, again, I think it's important to emphasize there's nothing... This case is about a lot of things that did not happen. He didn't stip to judicial fact-finding. He was never advised that he would be aggravated when he admitted to...
Mr. Martinez, if you take a second and address the question slightly exempt of whether there was a conviction that could be used here.
Whether the simultaneous conviction was prior?
Or does it have to be prior?
Well, the Court of Appeals in Meisenhelter 2 said it didn't because based on Villanueva in this case.
Tell us your thought about that.
I have a very different thought on that. I think that in Villanueva, it's factually distinct from this case. Those were not simultaneous temporally things that occurred. There was the attempted sexual assault on a child, I believe, and then subsequent stalking. Different time, different place. In this case, these things happened. One didn't happen. But if they did, they happened at the same time. I mean, the convictions entered at the same time.
Is the argument made here, apparently the court down below, I thought it as well, that Villanueva stood for the proposition that as long as there was a prior conviction before sentencing, that could serve as a likely exempt fact to allow aggravated sentencing? And if that's true, is this a question of another conviction before sentencing?
This is not a question of another conviction before sentencing. These happened at the same time.
Well, so when does the conviction, I mean, I'm trying to get the point you're making exactly. Are you saying it was not yet a conviction by the time of sentencing? Because the conviction has to include the sentence, or what exactly?
Well, you always have a conviction before sentencing. I mean, if you have a single conviction, it's before sentencing. And you can't use that to ag that single conviction because it's not a prior conviction.
Can I just follow up on this and maybe I can come at it from a different direction? So you're not so concerned about the fact that these convictions entered simultaneously. You just think that the second one, the one that you're calling the fictitious one, shouldn't count at all. Or am I oversimplifying that?
Yes. That's not what I mean.
Okay. Then could you help me, please?
Well, my main point is that he's never advised that by admitting to the bare elements of aggravated incest that he's giving up his jury rights under Apprendi and Blakely and that he's going to be aggravated. Okay, so that's that issue. That these occurred at the same time, do I think that they're Blakely exempt?
Well, if they were both good,
mm-hmm.
Are they Blakely exempt?
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you mean by good.
It doesn't matter that they entered at the same time, that they're simultaneous. Are they Blakely exempt vis-a-vis each other? That would follow. I think that's what you're saying. Isn't that right?
I don't... No, that does not make sense to me. If they happen at the same time, and in this particular case, one is fictitious, he's essentially being aggravated on the bare elements of the aggravated incest, which is the count that has a factual basis. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time if I could. No more.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Allen. I am here on behalf of the people. The question that we're here on, as far as what the court granted cert on, is whether the convictions at issue here were Blakely exempt. And I think it's important to look at this particular plea agreement, which was a complicated one. It's been going on for a long time. He pled to the wrong child abuse count in the first place, because that one was a mandatory sentence, which is why he was allowed to withdraw his guilty plea to get him to a child abuse count that was a non-mandatory sentence, so that he could argue for a lesser amount of time in the Department of Corrections and not get an indeterminate to life sentence. That was the whole point here. There's a stipulation to probation on the aggravated incest, which is the one that he was advised completely on the elements, waived his jury rights to all of those elements. And then there was this fictitious count added, which, because I almost feel like the argument is it's a fictitious count, so it shouldn't count. And you can't use what he pled to in the aggravated incest to aggravate this fake count that didn't really exist. But the whole point of adding the fictitious count was to get the plea bargain that he wanted. So he can't now argue that there are no facts to support the sentence to the fictitious count, which he waived a factual basis to. So, getting back to the issue, you have these two convictions that, yes, enter at the same time. I don't think the issue for Blakely exempt is it a prior conviction? I think the issue for Blakely exempt is, has the conviction been determined by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt or admitted by the defendant in a knowing and voluntary plea agreement? And the other, all of the other stuff that we're talking about goes to Blakely compliancy, for lack of a better term. When we're talking about Blakely exempt, we need to look at what happened during this plea agreement. And here, his jury rights were adequately protected by virtue of this knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of all of his rights during the plea proceedings. I think this court can obviously take a look at what went on during that. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask before you kind of go off of that point. So do you think that it's ever possible to have a Blakely exempt prior conviction? Let's just take the timing out of it when there's this, quote, fictitious count and a waiver of factual basis?
I think absolutely you can.
Is that the thrust of what this case is about in your mind, or is it more the timing, the simultaneous?
That's a good question. I think it's both. I think the fact that we have this fictitious count in here makes it easier to determine that the fact that they happen at the same time is okay for purposes of a Blakely exempt finding. Because, again, this was a plea agreement that they all agreed upon that he wanted, and he was completely advised, as was discussed earlier, of this 25-year cap. And there is no need in a Blakely exempt situation for a defendant to be advised that these elements that he's pled guilty to and done a valid waiver on, that those can be used to aggravate on the other count. There just isn't. So as far as some of this court's language in Isaacs and Villanueva is concerned, I don't think it applies here because, again, we're talking Blakely exempt and not Blakely compliant. And I think we need to keep those separate because it's important. The judicial fact finding and the other two for Blakely compliancy, there is more necessary than what is necessary with Blakely exempt.
So with Blakely exempt, is there anything more necessary than just that he pled guilty and this is the charge that he pled guilty to?
Well, I think the fact that the court specifically used the elements of the aggravated incest, and those were the ones of which he was advised and waived his rights, that the court specifically made those findings with respect to the age of the daughter and the other one. The court specifically made the findings that he waived all of his rights on those, and so that those could be used to aggravate the other. And that may not even have been necessary. It could have just been the fact that we have this other conviction to aggravate the child abuse.
Isn't that sort of right where concepts of Blakely exempt and Blakely compliant begin to get confused? Because I was understanding your argument to be the aggravator is the other conviction.
And
it doesn't have to be prior, it just has to be exempt, which it is because it's a conviction.
Right.
And the argument begins to bleed into the trial judge used facts that underlie the conviction, the elements of the conviction, as aggravators, which begins to sound then like a blatantly compliant argument.
Well, and it does because that's exactly what if this court recalls, that's exactly what the trial court did. I mean, the court of appeals is the one that threw in and even if it isn't Blakely compliant, it's Blakely exempt. At the trial court level, the trial court specifically found, we're not even dealing with Blakely exempt here. I'm finding that it's Blakely compliant, and it relied on Bass and Watts, which are very similar in as far as the court of appeals or the trial court in those cases was using the elements, the facts themselves of what either the jury found or he pled to aggravate the other charge, if that makes sense. And that's where the trial court went. So it does bleed by virtue of the trial court's findings, but I don't think that.
That's where you sort of get into the problem of did he have to be advised? Because setting aside the conviction and the exempt for a moment,
okay.
The trial judge is simply relying upon the facts that establish the elements. That's where the argument arises that in order for the judge to rely on that, he has to be advised not just that he's waiving the right to a trial on the charge, but he has to be advised that he's waiving the right to a jury trial on the determination of mitigating factors. Correct?
I don't think so.
And then explain again, he has to be advised that he's waiving the right to a jury trial as to the determination of the sentencing.
For a compliant, Blakely compliancy then, because I don't think it's necessary for exempt. But I think what the court's asking is, or my answer is, when it's not the elements of an offense, when it's something other than that, when it's facts that have to do with, you know, you violated probation because, and you're admitting that you drank and you had contact with someone that you weren't supposed to, and you go down the list. So you have to waive your jury trial rights and, according to this court, be advised that those facts that you are admitting to can be used to aggravate your sentence as well. But when you're talking about the elements, the strict elements of an offense, I don't think that that additional advisement is required. And I think that this court's, the language that this court has used in some of its cases supports that notion.
And that's precisely because those things are not determining whether judgment of guilt on the charge itself has the elements.
That's exactly right. They're
we
two
don't actually have to go there at all as to this issue, which is just about
Blakely exemption. That's exactly right. The issue is, you know, were his rights, Sixth Amendment and 14th Amendment rights, violated or not when he pled guilty? And so we look at the plea, we look at what happened during that providency hearing. And I mean, I think the record very clearly supports what the Court of Appeals found, which was that he waived his rights on the aggravated incest charge knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently. And so it was a proper Blakely exempt aggravating factor for the child abuse charge. And it's completely irrelevant that the child abuse charge was fictitious. I mean, the whole idea is that we've got this plea agreement that he wanted, which is why he pled to it, so he wasn't facing this indeterminate sentencing.
We discuss the simultaneous part.
I'm not real concerned about the I don't have a huge concern with the simultaneous part, because both convictions occurred before sentencing. And in particular here, when you're talking about, again, I hate to keep harping on it, but a plea agreement that these parties have worked on so that he can get the benefit of this bargain, I don't think the fact that the pleas were entered simultaneously matters at all as far as whether one of those convictions was Blakely exempt for the purposes of aggravating the other one, especially when you know full well that you're looking at 25 years. I mean, that couldn't have been made more clear.
Can I ask you a question again? Still circling around this question about what it means to be a conviction when it's final. I suppose those things were all involved in the Villanueva.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still a little curious. At least in Villanueva, I shouldn't answer this, but at least in Villanueva, we were talking about something that by the time we dealt with it was clearly a conviction, another conviction that could be likely. So we argued about whether that had to be before he committed the crime.
Right, right.
But here, does it make a difference? I mean, you just said that the other conviction, the one that was used as Blakely exempt, was a conviction before sentencing. Now, I can appreciate the importance of that. I mean, if you're looking at it from the point of view of how was the determination made that he was guilty, was that made in a reliable way? And we talked about that going the way both from Almendarez as far as all of those cases. But still, we use the term conviction kind of in terms of timing. We use it to mean different things. And Rule 32 would say you don't have a conviction until you have a sentence. For purposes of impeachment with a prior conviction, we say as long as the motion for new trial has been denied, you have a conviction. How do you see the timing here such that this simultaneous plea should count as a likely exempt factor at the sentencing, the very sentencing in which he's going to be sentenced for that time.
Well, I think what it comes down to is what does conviction mean for the purposes of Blakely exempt? What are we looking at when we talk about Blakely exempt? And what we're looking at is what happened during the plea or the jury trial where he's found guilty. We're not concerned with the sentence. We're looking at whether all of his rights have been violated or not violated at the plea. And so that's what's important, and that's why I think it's irrelevant that he hadn't been sentenced yet on one of those pleas for purposes of using it for aggravation for the other one.
Technically, wasn't he sentenced for count one first?
Is that the aggravated incest? I think he was.
So
theoretically. 30 seconds, yeah. Prior.
Would we return the distinction on whether you can use
I hope not.
But your whole point is that the distinction turns on the fact that the issue was decided by a jury, or that there was a right to have it decided by a jury, and that was waived.
Yes.
And that's what you say qualifies it as a Blakely exempt.
Yes, and the fact that this court can go back and look and see.
And that's the whole debate about what's the basis for exempting convictions to begin with.
Yes.
Is it recidivism, is it policy, or is it about the fact that there has been a right to a jury determination?
I think it's a combination of those things, but specifically the fact of the jury.
Is that precisely the wrong answer from your point of view? Because if it's about recidivism, you don't have it here.
I don't disagree, but recidivism, I can't say that it isn't about that at all, because it's been discussed so much. But I think the real point, the number one point, is whether the jury has determined beyond a reasonable doubt, or whether he has waived his rights validly on that plea. I mean, I think that there can be debate on some of the other parts of it, but I think that that's the most important thing for Blakely exempt. And I would just ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Just want to make a couple quick points, Your Honors. I don't think it's irrelevant that the child abuse count was fictitious, because under Leske, you can't aggravate it. Your aggravating facts have to be related to the crime that was charged. This was a fictitious, non-fact-based charge. So to me, it seems like it could not have been aggravated. There's nothing to aggravate it with. Nothing in reality.
So what do we have? Is this another case in which she ought to be able to go back and withdraw his pay? Is that what you're arguing for?
If you're offering that.
I'm not offering that.
Can I follow up on that, though, for a second?
Yes.
We're talking about Blakely exempt prior conviction.
Okay.
Why does it make any difference what the facts of that conviction are? If it's a conviction, it's Blakely exempt.
If it raises the
range to the top of the aggravated range.
If it's a prior conviction, but it's not here.
Oh.
Sorry,
let me ask you this. Would this case be any different if one of the charges was not, as you put it, fictitious? That is, to just do something radically different. The defendant's convicted of bribery and attempted assault, and the judge aggravates the bribery charge, saying, you know, not only did you try to bribe the officer, but you also tried to hit him. Does that put us in the same situation, or is that different because there is actually a factual basis for both counts? In other words, why does it matter that the factual basis was laid for one of the charges?
If we're talking bare elements, and there's nothing beyond those bare elements, and there's two separate crimes, same time, I think the legislature has ways to sentence those without having to use the facts of one to aggravate the other.
Generally speaking, you're saying you should not be allowed to use another conviction occurring at the same time to aggravate the other conviction.
Not if they're simultaneous.
Why?
Why
should that be prohibited?
Because the court has the ability to run those sentences consecutively, and there's other ways to sentence the defendant without having to start fact-finding beyond the bare elements of beyond what a jury found and beyond what the defendant waived.
Well,
But you're really here is to get the second count out. Let's get something signed first. I mean, you don't want a new trial and run the risk of conviction and an indeterminate sentence, right? You really don't want to withdraw the plea, but you, I mean, did I misconstrue what you asked for?
I didn't ask for it. It was suggested, or Justice Malarkey made that statement, and I said, are you offering that?
What remedy are you asking?
The road. I don't understand the plea agreement in this case. I think there's going to be a serious claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in here. It makes no sense to me, and possibly it'll happen then. I don't know.
What remedy are you asking for? Just
here?
Yes.
The court should reverse the court. This court should reverse the Court of Appeals and remand for sentencing to within the presumptive range, 4 to 16.
Why is that? That's contrary to what he agreed to, right?
No, it's not contrary to what he agreed to. It was just explained to him that there was a cap.
Right.
And
he took the risk that it would be aggravated, right?
You know, I'm not thinking that. I'm trying to remember which case. I think it might be Isaac's, but everybody in a number of this court's cases, the sentencing court will always advise this is the range. So somebody could argue that, well, he was advised, he was warned of this potential, he's taking the risk, right? They could say that. But it's just a standard advisement. And I think that in this particular case, because it's so odd, the record is not really clear, I think that 25-year cap, I'm guessing, based on the withdrawal of the first plea and the refiling of the second count and amending it to 4 to 16, I think that Mr. Meisenhelter anticipated 4 to 16-year sentence and that probably didn't understand the 25-year cap. I don't know. I think that it was based upon a presumption of maybe if there's anything aggravation found. So. Anyway, I ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and remand the case for resentencing within the presumptive range. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank counsel for your arguments. Case stands submitted.